Amanda Knox is back in the news. You'll remember Knox as the American college student who was convicted in 2009 of murdering her roommate, Meredith Kircher, while both women were attending a study abroad program in Perugia, Italy. Her case inspired some international outrage and a lot of sensational news coverage and a made-for-TV movie and a nickname, Foxy Knoxy, because people looked at her and said, ooh, she's an attractive young woman. Well, she was acquitted on appeal in 2011, and she was released from prison and came back home here to the United States. She's been attending college and writing a tell-all book that's coming out next month from HarperCollins. The publishers, however, may want to hold the presses on the book because this week, Italy's highest court overturned Amanda Knox's acquittal. She and her co-defendant, Rafael Solicito, are going to have to stand trial all over again. There are questions about whether the U.S. will allow her to be extradited back to Italy. Some people say that double jeopardy applies, but that's American law, not Italian law. And it's with the Italian law, or at least the judge in the case, that my next guest has a problem. Her name is Leila Schneps. She is a mathematician and a mystery writer who, along with her daughter Coralie Colmes, wrote a book called Math on Trial, How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom. Leila, welcome to America Weekend.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. You think that math was on trial here and the judge got it wrong, right?
I think there are a lot of things that happened in the appeal trial that acquitted Amanda Knox, actually, that were flawed. There were flaws all through the process, actually. But what I've noticed, particularly in the appeal, and that troubled me right up until it was overturned yesterday, and I semi-expected that would happen, is that the judge did make some significant errors, in my opinion, with the science.
Okay. Give me an example of what the judge got wrong.
Well, in particular, with respect to the DNA analysis, I think this is something that's not at all understood by people who are reading the news. So there were some pieces of DNA that played a very important role in the first trial, and they came and played a role again in the second trial, and above all, for instance, was one of them was some DNA that was found on a knife that was picked up by police from the home of Amanda's boyfriend, which was a place where the victim, Meredith Kircher, had never set foot. So police searched around the home of the boyfriend, picked up a sharp-looking knife from a drawer full of knives, but these are ordinary dinner knives, and this is the one actual big cutting knife, took it to the lab, and it was tested by the forensic police, and they find a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of DNA on the blade, but which has a profile of Meredith Kircher. So this is obviously could be looked at as a very damning piece of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble with the evidence was that it was just very, very small, the quantity, and it's actually lower than there have been actually cases in court where such small quantities haven't been accepted because there's background noise. When you have DNA, what it is it's a graph with peaks in the places where the DNA profile is and little tiny peaks which are from background noise of the machine. But when the quantity is small, the human peaks are low, and it's hard to distinguish them from background peaks. It's not reliable. In general, it's considered not reliable, and so it's very controversial to admit this kind of thing in court.
Okay.
However, in this particular case, and I think this is a thing that's not well understood, and you rarely see it actually stated in the press, the profile was completely clear. The quantity may have been small, the peaks may have been low, but they are placed exactly where Meredith's peaks are, and the background is much, much lower, so the profile is completely clear. So when you start assessing whether a piece of evidence like this is reliable or not, you want to take that into account and not simply say, it's a low amount, we don't usually admit this, so we're not going to admit it. So what happened is the appeal judge called in some experts, completely independent experts, to review what had been done on the knife, to review the work on this sample, and to see if you could swab the knife again, find any more material on it, and test that. Now, that would make sense, because if you had any doubts about this piece of material, you would swab the knife again and see if there's more. And, okay, at first it was said, well, that would be even less, and we don't have the technology to test this quantity even smaller than that. But you see, the appeal trial was 4 years after the original trial.
Mm-hmm.
And they did have the technology. In between, technology made these really big advances, and they could have actually tested a much smaller quantity than what was tested.
Mm-hmm.
And so these independent experts swabbed the knife, and they found a very, very, very small quantity, much smaller than the previous one, but now testable. And so the prosecution jumped on this and submitted a request to the judge to have it tested, which, when I say tested, I mean see if it's Meredith's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge refused it. And this is his reasoning. I found his reasoning very striking because it's explained, you know, in complete detail in this motivations report that judges in Italy are obliged to write whenever they make a judgment. So he says the first test was in a small quantity, and that is not considered fully reliable by the scientific community. The second test would be an even smaller quantity, so it would be even less reliable in terms of the scientific community. So you would gain nothing. What's the point of doing it? And the fact is that, in fact, mathematically speaking, if you have a test that's reliable, say, up to a certain percentage, and you do it again, you can gain a lot of reliability by combining the results of the two tests. This is really a fallacy. I understand that somebody, that a layperson, could actually say this. You do a test and you get a result with 80% reliability. You do it again, you get your same result. And it's, I understand that somebody could say, well, it's 80% reliable again. What have I gained? But in fact, you have a mathematical formula to combine the two tests. If you think about it intuitively, if you have a coin and somebody's told you, oh, that might be a biased coin, that might be weighted, and you toss your coin and you get 8 heads, say, you're going to think, oh, maybe I really do have the weighted coin. Then if you toss again 10 times and you get 8 heads, are you going to say, oh, it's still 8 times out of 10 that I have a weighted coin? No. You're going to... You can use a formula to combine these results, and actually you're not talking about 16 heads out of 20 throws, and that's much, much more convincing, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as I'm concerned, what the judge did was to reject an opportunity to get closer to the truth. This would have been able to confirm some things about that DNA. Was it really on the knife? Because that's been disputed. People have said, oh, it could have been lab contamination. But if they found a second sample on the knife, that would have confirmed that it was really on the knife. And was it really Meredith's? Again, it looks exactly like Meredith's, but it's true that the quantity is small and the peaks are low, and a second sample would have really indicated, or could have. You know, maybe nothing would have come out. I don't know. But it could have certainly confirmed and answered some of the questions that are out there. It could have brought us closer to the truth, and it was rejected.
It's part of the problem done. Here, and I'm sure this is one of the points that you bring up in your book, Math on Trial, Layla, is the judge didn't understand statistical probability points like that. And it's also very difficult for jurors to understand
that. Right. I think the judge acted in good faith when he said, but it would just not be reliable again, so what's the point? I think he just believed that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens quite a lot in other cases as well, that judges and lawyers fall into rather typical fallacies, and the jury isn't at all able to pick them up because they're simple. They're not that hard to explain. That's what we did in our book.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not well known.
And how much more difficult is it once you get past the judge? Let's say the judge had even allowed this in. Let's say it's a jury trial and you've got 12 Americans and you've got a country full of math phobics here. That makes mm-hmm. it even more difficult to make the case. And
well,
to get...
that's very interesting. As a matter of fact, this isn't only a problem in America. I mean, there's a problem in every country. And that was very recently, like less than a year ago, a case in England where the lawyers hired a mathematician to actually walk the jury through the calculation. And it was a case with very little evidence. So it was a really simple calculation. He didn't have to take a ton of evidence into account. It was some minor pieces of evidence and then a big DNA identification. And they wanted him to explain how you use the formula to calculate the probability of guilt given that DNA. And he walked the jury through. He actually had them all brought calculators. And they understood it. It's explained very clearly. I mean, I have the transcript of that trial. And they convicted. And verdict was overturned on appeal because it was judged that he was encroaching on the province of the jury. He was telling them how to think.
Oh.
And that traditionally, you really cannot do this.
So
you see,
I can't tell people
that are out there at every level.
I would think that if this were a scientist who was explaining how things worked in the lab, that would be admissible. But a mathematician telling people how the math works is not.
Yeah, that's
it's absolutely
strange.
Ridiculous. Layla's book, Layla's book is called A Math on Trial, How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom. And the Amanda Knox murder case is one of the cases that she covers in that, and a perfect example of what we're talking about here. Layla, thanks for joining me on America Weekend.
You're very welcome.
Paul Harris.
America Weekend.